In continuing clarifying this matter, this life, this three marks of life, impermanence, non-self, and unsatisfactoriness, I want to look a little at a section of the Shobo Genzo by Dogen Zenji titled Hachi Dai Nin Gaku, the eight awarenesses of a great person, an awakened person, an enlightened person, or could be called different ways to translate that. This section of the Shobo Genzo, in a way, is Dogen's restating of a teaching from the Mahaparinirvana Sutra, also called Eight Awarenesses, which is to be the a final teaching of Shakyamuni Buddha before his death. And if we look further, this Hachi Dai Nin Gaku is the last chapter of the Shobo Genzo written by Dogen before his death. He died in 1253, depending, of course, how we count life. He was 53, 52 years old. Japanese way of counting age is a little different from ours, since when you're born, you are 1 year old, and the year changing is not on your birth date, so to speak, but at the beginning of the year, at least at that time, that's the way it was counted. But in any case, the translation I'm using is by Maizumi Roshi and Francis Dogen Cook. So I'll read a little of the text, and then we will see how this connects with what we've been talking about, especially with unsatisfactoriness. All Buddhas are enlightened persons. Those things which enlightened persons are aware of are called the eight awarenesses of enlightened persons. To become aware of this Dharma is the cause for Nirvana. Our Master Shakyamuni Buddha taught this on the last night before entering Parinirvana. First, having few desires, not seeking too much among the objects of the five desires which are not yet obtained, is called having few desires. The Buddha says, you monks should know that because those who have many desires search for fame and profit, there is much suffering. Those who have few desires look around less and desire little. Therefore, they have no worry of this sort. You should practice if only to have few desires. Needless to say, having few desires produces many merits. Those who have few desires do not have to flatter in order to ingratiate themselves with others. Also, They withstand temptations from the various sense organs. One who practices few desires has neither worry nor fear, for their mind is peaceful. Whatever they come into contact with, they find it is enough, and they never lack anything. Having few desires, they are in nirvana. This is called having few desires. The second, knowing how to be satisfied. Knowing how much to take of those things which one already has is called knowing how to be satisfied. The Buddha says, you monks, or you practitioners, translating it, you monks, is a little narrow translation, but so be it, should contemplate knowing how to be satisfied if you wish to be liberated from suffering. The Dharma of knowing how to be satisfied is the realm of riches, comfort, peace, and tranquility. Those who know how to be satisfied are happy and comfortable, even when sleeping on the ground. Those who do not know how to be satisfied are not satisfied, even when dwelling in a heavenly palace. Those who do not know how to be satisfied are poor, even though they are wealthy, while those who know how to be satisfied are wealthy, even though they have little. Those who do not know how to be satisfied are always tempted by the five desires. Those who do not know how to be satisfied and are always tempted by the five desires are consoled by those who know how to be satisfied. This is called knowing how to be satisfied. In a way, you can see right away, using the word satisfied connects very directly with this third mark of existence, the dukkha, which I've translated as unsatisfactoriness or suffering, or various other ways we can translate it. But this is what Shakyamuni Buddha, this is what Dogen Zenji is talking about. He's talking about, in a way, you could see that the first and the second of these two are, in a way, mirror images of each other. The first is not seeking too much, having few desires, not seeking too much about what not yet obtained. And the second is knowing how much to take of those things which one already has, knowing how to be satisfied. In a way, if seeking too much is the fundamental point of, in the three marks of existence, seeking permanence in that which is inherently impermanent, seeking exerting self in that which is non-self, guaranteed to create suffering, guaranteed to create unsatisfactoriness. It's only in a sense when we turn this that we can be satisfied, that we can be joyous as we are in what one already has. Notice the already has. You have the whole universe. You have the whole universe, your whole life, this moment. But if we don't know how to be satisfied, then even there we get in trouble. And that's exactly what both the Buddha and Dogen point to. This knowing how to be satisfied. Notice it's this knowing how to be satisfied as opposed to being satisfied. In a way, there's interesting resonances in the Jewish tradition, in what's known as the sayings of the elders, which is, let's see, chronologically about 200 or 300 years after the Buddha, in terms of the origin, there's a statement, Eizehu Osha Hasameach Bechalke. Who is the rich person, the one who knows how to be satisfied with what they have? Knowing how to be satisfied, or knows how to be joyous with what they have. Or we can say it in another way, not knowing what, so we get all confused and we believe things, habits, which lead us to be unsatisfied, lead us to suffer in the midst of this life that we have, this life that we are, of course, have and are just different ways of translating, and we could get caught in the English, what do we have, what do we not have. I will stay with these two, though I want to point out one other of the eight awarenesses, just so that, even though I won't go into it, I won't read all the rest, but the fourth awareness is called exerting meticulous effort. Exerting oneself meticulously and unceasingly in various beneficial practices is called meticulous effort. Be precise, not careless. Proceed forward. Do not regress. If the Buddha says, if you practitioners exert meticulous effort, nothing will be difficult to accomplish. Therefore, you should make an effort to practice carefully, for when water flows constantly against a big rock, even a small amount of water will eventually dig out a large hole. But if one who practices is lax, it is impossible to accomplish anything. It is like trying to start a fire by rubbing two sticks together. If you stop rubbing before the wood gets hot, you can start a fire. This is what is called, this is what is meant by meticulous effort. So this knowing how to be satisfied, or alternatively, knowing, discovering, clarifying where and how we become entangled, which creates unsatisfactoriness in the midst of joyousness, in the midst of who and what our life is, in the midst of a sufficient life creating all sorts of insufficiencies. In the midst of being Buddhas, we deny our Buddhahood. We deny the Buddhas that we encounter from morning to night. So, one way we see this is in meticulous, ongoing practice. Meticulously being able to see what's called for. See, the knowing how to be satisfied. It's not saying you should be satisfying as a command, but knowing the practice that enables you to be satisfied, and knowing skillfully, appropriately, what to seek for, in a way, what aspirations, what are the desires. In some ways you could say practice is a great desire, and certainly the practice of bodhisattvas to liberate all beings, to serve, save all beings, is a great desire. Certainly if you look at various Buddhas, there's Buddhas who have the desire to save all sentient beings, or sometimes Amida Buddha, Amitabha Buddha, vows to forego personal accomplishment, personal awakening, until liberated all beings. Think how great. You could say, hey, you don't know how to be satisfied. And yet, his ability, her ability, his, her, doesn't make a difference in this case. In fact, an emanation of Amitabha is Kuan Yin, and Kuan Yin is sometimes so-called female, sometimes so-called male. Whatever personal pronoun one uses, don't get caught. Sometimes you have to clarify that the personal pronoun is female, because too much using the male, or vice versa, but it's neither female nor male. Therefore can be male. Because can be whatever this moment is. Just Buddhas that we meet. Knowing how to be satisfied. Knowing how to be satisfied, knowing how much to take of what one already has, or being able to meticulously practice when effort is needed because one believes one does not have. Because one believes one is lacking, what's the effort needed? So that we can know how to be satisfied where we are. What is it, if I say it the other way, what is the worm in the apple when, despite having an apple, we complain? Despite having all sorts of things, we go looking elsewhere. We go believing, I need this and that, because this and that thought, feeling arose, this and that reaction to what someone else said and did, means that I have to give up my being present joy in order to become angry at him or her or them. Knowing how to be satisfied in one's own Buddha mind, in one's own joyfulness, means that we don't get tempted by, or we notice how and where we're being distracted and what meticulous effort is needed, so that we don't buy into the greed, anger, confusion, which arises beginninglessly, not because there's any fault, but just because of ongoing change, cause and effect, that we can call karma, we can call it all sorts of other things. Those habits arise, and yet those are our opportunities to know how to be satisfied, as opposed to buying in, being unsatisfied, dissatisfied, being suffering. In one sense, we could talk about these eight awarenesses as cumulative, progressive, and in another sense we could talk about that, in other words, as prescriptive, do such and such and you will, and you can, as prescriptions of practice and accomplishments. In another way, we could talk about these as descriptive of who and what we are, and descriptive enables us to also see the aspect where, in a sense, when we go away from it, when we entangle, we miss what's so, we misconstrue what's so. Therefore, even being wealthy, we're unsatisfied, dissatisfied, not joyous. This is an image, of course, some of you might be familiar, used in some of the other sutras. It's like a rich person going off wandering, or the son of a rich person going off wandering, getting lost, and thinking that they're truly poor, only discovering the jewel in their pocket that's been there all along through whatever fortunate circumstances, or failing to discover it because keep looking out there elsewhere. That's what greed, anger, confusion is about, what causes us to look and react elsewhere. That's why they're such insidious habits, such insidious, pervasive, reactive habits. You don't have to use those forms of them because they manifest in various other forms. Those are just nice broad categorizations. Greed meaning pulling things towards us, anger is pushing things away from us, and confusion is confusion or ignorance of what our life is. There's different ways to articulate it, and that in a way is our practice, because we have to take care of it just how it is now. We don't need to know any great concepts, just need to be able to take care of it how it is now. Not because we have some rules, but because we've know how, what practice is. We can be meticulously practice in this particular moment of our life. Moment of our life. Oh, okay. I've talked a lot on this, so I will stop now, and we can clarify this further in terms of our own practice, because that's what the point of bringing this up. That's the point of Buddha talking about this, to especially just before his death. It's to encourage and support That's the purpose of Dogen Zenji. Talking, writing, writing this, and at that point it wasn't as if Dogen didn't know he was sick. I don't know how sick, but he had been sick for several years, was getting weaker, and so he knew his end was coming. And in a way, it's his picking this. Certainly one could say that there's a resonance and an awareness of this being attributed as the last teaching of Shakyamuni Buddha in the Mahaparinirvana Sutra, for him to pick this as his last. Whether he knew it was the last or suspected, but it was certainly one of the last teishos that he gave, one of the last talks he gave and wrote down before he died. Okay, so I'll stop now and we can clarify this further. Descriptions of Buddha, descriptions of our life, descriptions of awakening, prescriptions of how to practice and accomplish what slowly manifests and develops, all and any of that. Okay, so I'll stop now, and if you need to, please change your positions and we can clarify this matter further. I think several years ago I talked about this or these eight awarenesses. I have a vague memory, but as I said, this fits very well with talking about unsatisfactoriness or suffering, which is a third of the Trilakshana, the three marks, three characteristics of existence, of life, which I've been talking about. So I thought I'd pick this up.
So what is the difference? Maybe it's more subtle than I think, of knowing how to be satisfied versus just being satisfied.
Well, how would you make them as different? How would you, what would you say, or how would you say they're not different?
How I would say they're not different?
In knowing how to be satisfied, remember when it's articulated, it's knowing how much to take of those things which one already has, or knowing how to take what one already has, knowing how to meticulously make use of what one has, is also knowing how, let us say, to be attached or not attached, how to use what we have but not let it become something that uses us and results in us becoming entangled in suffering out of the ongoing change that what we have, what we are, the ongoing change in circumstances and the ongoing non-self. See, knowing how points to more fundamental. Satisfied is I'm satisfied today, but what if what I have changes tomorrow? What if my condition changes tomorrow, so-called? See, it's the knowing how much to take so that it doesn't depend on having or not having certain things. It's the knowing is the functioning, the Buddha wisdom, if I say it that way, as opposed to I have 1, 2, 3, that's what I need to be satisfied with. If I have 2, that's not good. If I have 5, that's not good either. See, then we create satisfaction in the things that we do or don't have. Knowing how means that describes our functioning in this moment of ongoing change.
So that doesn't imply, I mean, knowing how doesn't imply that the person could be not satisfied, but they know how to be satisfied, but they maybe choose not to. Or
I don't. That's a little too fancy.
Yeah.
Choose not to be satisfied. Well, that's saying I'm going to choose to suffer. You know what? I just want to choose to suffer. Because satisfied, in a way, is a synonym for suffering. Or not suffering. Unsatisfied and suffering. So you could choose it, sure. But that's sort of just... I don't know that makes sense.
In your previous talk that you referred to...
Yeah.
The way you described...
Which previous
it,
one?
Well, you talked about the... knowing how to be satisfied before in your talk.
Yeah, I don't. You remember what I talked about? Wow, I don't remember at all.
I don't remember yesterday's talk, but I remember this, the one from 5 years ago. You said you described it as dissatisfaction, appreciating the fact that not being satisfied is a human condition,
uh-huh.
aspect of being a human being,
uh-huh.
and what they're talking about and the way you described it was knowing how to be satisfied with being dissatisfied.
Uh-huh.
And that was the difference.
Okay. Good. So there it is. Someone said that once upon a time.
My Zumi, what I really liked about his perspective on this is appreciating. I think uh-huh. it's a much better word than... sometimes, satisfied,
yeah.
we think dissatisfied. Appreciating in the larger context of being fully cognizant of and embracing.
Oh, many people have a hard time with the word appreciate because they think appreciate means
like.
And I don't appreciate something means I don't like it. But that isn't...
Yeah, I mean it in the larger context of...
But satisfied is a closer word to what
sure
Dogen and Buddha is saying. Mm-hmm. Remember, in some ways what Dogen Zenji is doing is he's restating and re-articulating what the Mahaparinirvana Sutra says and then adding in a sense his own comments in the way he says it and the way he phrases it.
Well, being satisfied is, I want to say, antithetical to our culture. I mean, it's about progress and innovation and not being satisfied with anything. It's something that we're surrounded with almost constantly.
Well, it's interesting that we think in order to have innovation, we have to not be satisfied.
Necessity is the mother of invention.
Well, but see, necessity and satisfied is different.
Yeah.
See, the point he makes, the Buddha makes and the point Dogen Zenji makes, it's knowing how to be satisfied with what one has. Doesn't mean you can't want to invent something new. But if you don't know how to be satisfied, then even if you find a new invention, you still won't be satisfied. So you accomplish this new invention, whatever it is, new app.
That's time for a better one.
But you're not satisfied, which means you continue to suffer. And remember, what the Buddha's teaching is focused on is being able to be joyous, being able to be satisfied, being able to not suffer. end of life. It's not about how much or how little you have. That's that quote from Pirkei Avos, sayings of the elders, is the rich person is the one who is satisfied with what they have. It doesn't mean you can't go do other things, but you, if you are not satisfied with what you have, then you're never going to be able to enjoy, no matter how much you accomplish, no matter how much you get, because then you're always on, okay, I got this, what's the next big thing? Which means we're always on this, I need more, always I'm not enough, always this is not enough, which in a sense results in a life of suffering, or can result, let's say it that way. Now, of course, practitioners, there's a question of what we make our efforts towards and where we put our attention and where we put our life's energies.
Our meticulous effort.
Yeah.
Well, Amitabha Buddha is a good example. Fully cognizant that there's no one to save, he dedicates his life to saving everyone.
Yes. And, but yet, you have to seriously... It's a serious effort,
yeah,
to there liberating are, all beings.
It must be done. Yes.
Oh. Yeah. After I give a talk, most of the time I have to forget it in order to be able to give the next talk. Otherwise...
That's why I would record them. But I interrupted...
No, I just wanted to repeat what you said so I could
what
stick it
say?
In my mind.
I don't know.
What did it sound like? Does anybody remember?
Well, it'll be on the tape after session. you were talking about... I don't know. About being satisfied.
Oh, your previous
point. Right.
Yeah, I got it. Okay.
Yes, yeah. I was dissatisfied.
Knowing how to be satisfied with being dissatisfied.
Okay. In the midst of it.
In the midst of when dissatisfaction arises. See, in a sense, all sorts of conditions and circumstances arise. I have to turn to you because otherwise with one eye I can't. All sorts of conditions and circumstances arise. It's not the conditions that we need to try to control, because of course we can't. But it's being able to be satisfied when those conditions arise allows us to live and do what's skillful and appropriate and called for, or to use the words, exert meticulous effort, which means being present, which means experiencing, which means responding according to circumstances, which means we have to be able to welcome even dissatisfactions when they arise, or troubles, or anger and fear. So it's not the anger and fear, but the building and entangling in them and articulating them and going around in them that creates their arising and passing are just arising and passing.
Not to get caught in them.
And not, and the building on them.
Right.
See, the building on them is what we essentially do, or the feeding of them, or the doing what nurtures them, if I use that kind of word. And each of us know for ourselves very well what, where we, quote, know how to be satisfied, close quote, and where we, quote, don't know how to be, or refuse to be, or habitually react out of unsatisfied, because it's very subtle. See, just like the first one was talking about having few desires, the knowing how to be satisfied with what we have, knowing how to attend and be present with what we have. It doesn't mean just physical things, but all the life circumstance moment that we have. Knowing how to be satisfied means meticulous experiencing presence. Or not knowing how, meaning being caught up in habits so that we miss this very life. We don't appreciate this moment because we're always somewhere else, somehow else, somewho else.
What about this?
What's this?
Let's say you're satisfied, but with what you have materialized, but
okay.
There's another antique.
Oh.
Yeah.
Okay.
That you just would like to have.
Sure.
Is that being unsatisfied, even though you say satisfied, but just because it'd be nice to have another one?
Here's a nice test. First, of course, we assume you have this money for this antique.
Yeah,
and, well, and let's give a few tests. What happens if you, you're going to this, estate sale where you saw this antique today, and this morning, all of a sudden, someone calls you up and says, "I need you to drive me to the hospital." And you say, "I can't do that. No, I got to go to this antique sale. I can't take you to the hospital." Or, "Oh, I don't feel well today. I have to stay in bed." "Oh, that's so terrible. I'm not going to go. Someone's got to go to the antique sale. They got to get that for me." Or you go to the antique sale and someone else has got it already. Or they're having a bidding and you bid what you think and someone else bids more and you add a little more and you start getting then we begin to see, is it just something that's offered and available and therefore I choose it, or is it something that entangles me in all sorts of troublesome,
like greed, or
we don't have to call them by names. See that? We could see the specifics. It's always in the specifics. What if you meet someone else who's already bought it and they show it to you and you're with them and you're just boiling on the inside? They got that and I didn't. Or it was a friend who had the antique and was giving it away and gave it, that antique, to someone else and gave you a different one, and you really wanted that one and you didn't want this one, and you find, see, then we know whether we know how to be satisfied or whether we, I just happened to want it, or see, then we in a sense see what we're doing. But in a way, we've set up the situation. You set up the.
Right.
It's really a matter of very simple things. It's not antiques and things that we buy are easy. It's not necessarily about things. It can be about what words someone says or doesn't say, or what happens in terms of the weather or doesn't happen. Or what happens in terms of how my body feels when I wake up in the morning or in the middle of the day. Or who knows my good example offered by some people, which sports team wins what? Can you be satisfied no matter which team wins? What's going on? The NBA, NBA. NBA. The NBA playoff. Which team wins? Does it make a difference if it's Oklahoma or Oakland? Or would it be terrible if whichever one you want or don't want to win wins? See, do we know how to be satisfied? Or do we not? And usually those sorts of things are easy to see, where you can or can't be satisfied. Now, you could root for whichever team you want. As I've said this before, and I've mentioned this to a number of you, if you're a sports fan, a great practice opportunity is to watch a game with whatever team you like, playing whoever, and for part of the game, root for your team, and for part of the game, root genuinely for the other team to win.
Nobody ever gonna do that.
This is not
because you don't root for either side. You don't give a shit, right? Exactly. There's no way you can do that.
Because
it's the definition of rooting for a team is you don't turn around in the middle of the game and say, "Oh, I think I want the Golden State now."
Why not?
It's not.
Why not?
Rooting. It's now you've changed the definition of rooting for a team.
Because you get so entangled between so-called self and so-called team that we can become angry and upset.
No.
Unfortunately, we know that let us say, not in basketball, but in soccer, there have been fans have gotten into fights, and actually people have been killed with riots because the wrong team won. So, but this is in a way that's an extreme example, but in a way you could say it's such a unimportant thing, except for those who think it is important. And the point of practice is to allow us to appreciate what's important and significant in life and what isn't. Knowing how to be satisfied, knowing how, or not knowing how. See, if we choose, I've got to have that antique, then we attribute self-permanence to the antique, to having the antique, to what is going to make us satisfied or not, and then what do we get? We get people fighting, suffering, causing suffering for themselves, causing suffering and harm to others. And we can see it in all sorts of ways. That's why we talk about meticulous practice, because this seems so natural to us. That's what Monshin said. No one's going to want to do that. Who cares about sports? And yet,
who cares about their team?
Who cares about their team? And yet, we create teams of all sorts of things based on, do I have this, do I not have this? Who said this to me, or who didn't say this to me? Who invited me to their party, and who didn't invite me to their party? See, it's that those areas where we create suffering that need not be suffering. We create unsatisfactoriness in life that is joyous, and yet we, if I say it, sully our Buddha nature, if I use that kind of word. Of course we can't, and yet somehow we manage, we manage to create. That's what Matsu was talking about yesterday, how we create these difficulties.
Well, aren't there some times when you do have to take a stance?
Sure. Like, all sorts of times. Let's not go to specifics, because it always depends on what's happening now, what's called for, who's involved, and what's appropriate, and what's your role. I mean, we could get, but let's say it this way. If you're playing a sport, play it all out. Play meticulous, persistent effort to play your sport. If you're playing basketball, great. Do your best. Try to win the game. Wonderful. And know the difference between whether you're playing the game or you're all entangled about who's rooting for which game and which team I'm rooting for, and if my team wins or loses. Then even worse, if you become upset with someone else who's rooting for a different team, even though they're your workmate or your relative, much less your son or parent. See, this is the sort of thing. I know some of you are familiar with this. Knowing how to be satisfied with what we have very much links in with the difficulties families sometimes have over inheritances, over who got what and who, and then how that creates ongoing harm and suffering. Why? Because we don't see clearly what's what, and instead we create suffering where we need not live in suffering. We try to create permanence and self out of what I have and what I don't have, or what she has or she doesn't have, or she should have or I should have, and so on and so forth. That's why our practice is so that we can know how to appreciate what we have. Even simple things like the breath of this moment, like the ability to sit upright and be present, knowing how to appreciate that, or not knowing how and therefore missing our very life. It's always here, here, and here manifests in myriad circumstances. I remember it was a meal, and the food was being passed down, and someone saw that for some reason there wasn't quite as much as they wanted. They were at the end of the line, and there wasn't quite as much as they wanted, and they got quite upset about that there had been more earlier, and they were the others were getting bigger portions, and as it got less and less, they got smaller portions. And yeah. So the meal, the orioke service, which orioke is about having just the right amount, that's what literally means, the bowl and having just the right amount, became about We can do it with all sorts of things. You all know kids can fight about who cut the cake and which piece is bigger and
kids.
Smaller.
Adults do the same thing.
Adults can be kids when it comes to reactive habits.
Humans,
yeah. That's right. Reactive. So that's why Dogen Zenji and Shakyamuni Buddha put such emphasis on these great awarenesses of, you know, knowing, having few desires, and knowing how to be satisfied. If we don't know how to be satisfied, and even if we get what we want, then we look, we say, yes, please give me that piece. And then we look and say, how come you gave them two pieces, you got a bigger piece than me. And she got, look at the topping she got. She got more of the topping than I did. I didn't get that much icing. I need more icing.
The rose is on hers.
See, and what do we get from that? See, this is the practice point. And it's not, it's easy to talk about others, but the practice point is always to see, how does this arise for me? That's the meticulous practice, to notice where this arises for me. And when it does, what's skillful practice for me? Because satisfaction is who we are. It's not about criticizing others or making rules, but to allow us to be satisfied, to be joyous in this life that we are, rather than covering it over with what makes difficulties lower.
Yeah, and then there's also the find it interesting, a place of making a, I don't know what the word was, but the diligent effort in your practice.
Yeah.
And how yet that can also become something where there is a desire in making the practice into something. So
yeah.
We talk about being satisfied and sitting on the cushion and experiencing the grasping of, you know, this moment, I want this moment something else, or whatever the case may be.
Yes.
That I think is so much part of practice, exactly that. The to be willing to just notice rather than either having the practice and winning a prize, right? It's like making it into this, whatever, I'm going to get something from doing it.
Mm-hmm.
And yet having the good, diligent effort that is
yes.
willing to and then throw it away. But for me, I found that very, just very interesting. Mm-hmm. There's a subtle place there where
yeah.
the desire can come into the practice too.
Yeah. Yeah.
I like that word, diligent. I think that's a good word.
Yeah,
and attentive.
The word that used in this translation is exerting oneself meticulously and unceasingly. Meticulous, diligent, meticulous, unceasingly. In a way, diligent combines those two. Yes, be precise, not careless.
So then there is that desire is driven by the idea and expectation of a specific outcome.
Ah, that's added.
What is it?
That's added. To get the specific outcome is yes. added. Added. ADDED.
Right.
Excuse my accent. It's extra.
In talking about what desire?
No.
What
is it,
desire?
No. It's added. To have a specific doing an effort or being diligent or meticulous in order to have a specific outcome is added. Yes.
Sometimes though, when I hear something like those particular words about diligent, meticulous practice,
uh-huh.
just those words sort of already come with, or in, to me when I hear them, they come with, like they're, like in my mind, an outcome is already packaged with that.
Yes.
That if you're meticulous, you're going to have this outcome, or if you're diligent, of course you're going to have this outcome.
And
that's obviously not the way that's right. intended, but.
And that's good for us to notice that we add that outcome automatically almost and say it's natural. Sometimes we add on efforts and sometimes we add on stress with those words. So the way we manifest is with an added stress, an added tension, an added judging even. And our practice is to notice what we add. See, that's why it's so much in the being present in the experiencing, because then we notice the added tension. We notice it either in our sitting. You know, we could tense in order to sit upright, which is added extra and in a way counterproductive, if I say it in such a way. And we see it in all sorts of other activities. It hinders us in. It hinders breathing. If we try to breathe meticulously, then our breathing becomes labored. And what's important is to notice that if we get trapped by the words, then it's our to notice what we are adding on to the words or what we are bringing along without consciously necessarily seeing them, but we're bringing along as if they naturally are part of these words. And words don't have to have that except they seem for us naturally to have that, and it might be for lots of other people. And that's why it's important to clarify. That's why, in a way, when we talk about this, there's an attempt to clarify some of this so that we don't... So when we say having few desires, it's clarified not seeking too much among the objects of the five desires which are not yet obtained. And then... question, it's us to see what is this too much, what is
So what does Buddha say about meticulous practice again? Because it sounds like it's okay. Kind of outcome oriented.
Okay. It says, exerting oneself meticulously and unceasingly in various beneficial practices is called meticulous effort. Be precise, not careless. Proceed forward, do not regress.
Monks, if you
exert meticulous effort, nothing will be difficult to accomplish. Of course, here it's in terms of that. Remember, there's three different ways we could look at these. Traditionally, this is called looking at these texts from a so-called Hinayana, so-called Mahayana, and a Buddhayana way. Three different approaches. Now, in a way, I talked about this, saying that these can be both descriptive of how one moves along, or it could be almost proscriptive in the sense of what one should do and what one gets, or it could be a way of seeing as what one is. Now, Hinayana sense is a very random. Don't equate Hinayana with Theravada. That this is just approaches. Hinayana means in a very narrow, literal sense. And Mahayana is seen as a flexible, appropriate to circumstances. And Buddhayana, which means Buddha nature or Buddha vehicle, yana is vehicle, is seeing it in a sense of non-dualistic, not separation of self and others. So looking at it from the point of that fundamental. But just remember, these are different perspectives or facets. Don't get caught in them as being different. They're ways to emphasize different aspects of what's skillful to clarify. They're not solidly different things, mutually exclusive, better or worse, or anything else like that, which we tend to do. When we use language, if we get caught in the language, and the language becomes a barrier itself. So, anyway, that's. But I didn't go into this fourth one, exerting meticulous effort, so I don't know if I. So, of course, the examples that Buddha uses has to do with water on a rock or rubbing sticks to get fire. Sometimes you have it trying to get water by digging a hole and digging a hole a few feet and then stopping and then digging a hole a few feet and stopping, digging a hole a few feet, or else just digging and digging and digging till eventually, no matter how deep you have to go, eventually the water comes. But you have to see those as analogies used to describe ongoing practice to people who were very much, to whom these activities were very much ordinary day activities, ordinary events that they would encounter, whether digging or making fire or water on falling on something. And that's, rather than speaking conceptually, the Buddha was speaking very immediate, something that so that people could get what the point he was trying to make. And he was saying different things according to where he was, so it wasn't as if there was this great compendium of past Buddhist knowledge that these people knew. No. I mean, he was wandering around and he was saying this to this group of people who happened to be here, and this might be all that they hear from him. So, anyway. And certainly, most of you, well, some of you might know, Dogen's Shobo Genzo and what his writings were directed specifically to those who were practicing with him, and actually for five centuries or more, no one his stuff was very little known because they were just different chapters in different temples. They had it as their own manuscripts, and most people never, even those who could read, never got exposed to it because it wasn't available. On the other hand, we know once Buddhist texts were printed or written down, that in many parts of Asia, Buddhist texts were printed and made available. And in fact, the first complete printed book that it exists in the world is a book of the Diamond Sutra that was printed, not handwritten, but printed.
Press?
Yes, printed in the year 898, I think, or some year. That's the first printed book, complete book that we have. Before that, they have earlier books that were printed, but they only have pieces. But the first complete whole book that we have that's dated is the Diamond Sutra from, I think it's from China, that was printed 898 or something like that, which is significantly earlier than when we get to printing in the West, which is in 1500 or 1400 with Gutenberg. Yeah, which is many, many centuries later. Okay. I've gone off a little in different directions. Any other point? Jeff, did you want to say something?
Well, it's hard for me to say this. I don't quite know how to make it into a question or discussion point, but getting caught up, I mean, I'm certainly caught and was seeking, I mean, greed, anger, and delusion were certainly, you know, a part of my existence, but I was also trying to work a practice at the same time. Getting sick, getting physically and mentally ill, has really put the whammy on all of this. You know, I hear the talk and I just don't know what to do with being caught up in the results of all the confusion. You know, it's happened. And yes, so much more has been layered on top of the problem. Because it's happened, the problem's just gotten layered and layered and layered.
Yes.
And I don't know what to do about the things like not having known how to organize money and how that has become a great stress and great fear.
Yes.
Anyway, I could go on and on trying to tease this out a little bit, but it's,
well, in a way you make a good point, which is a point for all of us, of attending to what's here now and noticing when we're going off into what's not here now and how much that can entangle, make for anxiety and fear that overwhelms us. And the, in a sense, if I say the antidote or the best prescription is to keep returning to what's called for or needed here now, whether in simple things like breathing here, being here, listening to what is being said to us, responding, or here now in terms of daily activities here now, including whether it's something as simple as preparing food or something as more complex as in planning which appointments I need to make and who and how I could get there and with whom. And so it's always attending to the now is the first, quote, general prescription, and noticing how other habits, physical, mental, and so forth, can get in the way if we let them, if we are overwhelmed by them, or if we hold on to them, and that coming back to here is the perfect antidote to those overwhelming fears. Not that they doesn't mean that it's going to fix them or that they won't arise, but it will enable us to take care of what's possible and called for now.
Working with a disability is just totally different than working with being an able person.
Yes.
It's amazing.
Yes. Yes. Thank you.